Our production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, Josh Salem, Sam Bauman, Jasmine Moss, Mattia Carlin, and David Rosenberg. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Shantia Hudson, Alex Gonzalez, Mark Richardson, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is, as always, Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Nathaniel Kapp. All of our KBOO programming, including this evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
An art installation and event series called Policing Justice is open at the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art from February 23rd through May 19th. The project features the work and voices of local, national, and international artists and activists exploring the past, present, and future of policing in Portland. In early March, KBOO reporters Jasmine Moss and Sam Bauman spoke with two of the folks involved in organizing the project, journalist Max Smith and co-curator Nina Amstutz.
Policing Justice is an exhibition currently on display at the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art that examines police violence in Portland and its relationship to longer local and national histories of oppression. In addition to the multimedia art installation, the exhibition is accompanied by several programs taking place through March and April. We're joined today by Nina Amstutz, Associate Professor of the History of Art and Architecture at the University of Oregon, who along with Cleo Davis curated the exhibition, and Mac Smith, journalist and moderator for one of the panels. Mac was also commissioned to write an essay which appears in the exhibition packet. Nina, Mac, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So Policing Justice opened just under 4 years after the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis and the racial justice demonstrations that followed. Of course, it wasn't only the killing of Mr. Floyd that fueled the protests in 2020. Communities all across the country have lists of the names of those they've lost to white supremacist and state-sanctioned violence. Portland is no exception. Nina, you and Cleo put together an exhibition that, as you wrote in your curatorial statement, offers an opportunity to reckon with our situated histories and imagine futures that have long been out of reach. Could you start by providing us with an overview of the inspiration behind this exhibition and the central themes you hope the audience will engage with through the artwork?
Of course, yeah. So the exhibition really does emerge out of 2020. And, you know, what was most striking about these protests about police or against police brutality was the extent to which they were met with so much police violence. And that happened certainly nationally, but it especially happened locally. As many of our listeners will remember, those protests had lasted longer in Portland than anywhere else in the country. And they were met with just a tremendous amount of police use of force. And use of force like that on that scale usually doesn't come out of nowhere. There's always a larger history and context that led us to that point. And we really hoped in this exhibition to unpack that history. And we asked a series of local artists and organizations to sort of think through that history from different perspectives. And so the artists have looked at the history of policing in Portland from the intersecting perspectives of racial, environmental, juvenile, and spatial justice. And their projects all sort of start from one of those jumping off points, but they go much further. And the artists, you know, they were asked to look at this material sort of from a historical perspective, but we also want this exhibition to really take stock of, you know, what has happened in the last 4 years towards police accountability. And also the artists have sought to imagine a variety of different futures as well for public safety. And so where do we kind of go from here is also a central theme that we hope viewers will take away from it.
Thank you. And as you mentioned, it was sort of a collaborative process with the local community groups and artists and researchers responding to a general prompt. Can you, either one of you, can you share a specific example of a piece that demonstrates how this collaborative process resulted in the final work that we'd see at the exhibition?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to speak to that. And so, you know, I think that every single project really, you know, started with kind of one initiating artist or group that, you know, really kind of works in the specific area that we wanted to look at. And so Don't Shoot Portland, for instance, that, you know, they have a real expertise in the history of racist policing in our community. And so their project is very much, or their organization is very much a community organization, not only in the art making process, but also in terms of the ways in which they mine and liberate the archive, which is central to their installation. They have documents that look at the history of racist policing here that date back to the 1920s. And they bring those into dialogue with more recent material. And so, you know, their process has been one of working with universities, working with community members, and also in relation to the exhibition, they worked very closely with the research and arts agency in Britain called Forensic Architecture, which also has an installation in the exhibition. And Forensic Architecture, they created an installation that includes an investigation into the use of tear gas locally, and their work has a real global reach. They're based in Britain, and they investigate human rights violations really around the world, but they rely heavily on local collaboration as well. And so Don't Shoot Portland worked closely with them. Don't Shoot Portland also, you know, commissioned their own report on riot control agents locally that then sort of fed into Forensic Architecture's research. And so the collaboration there, I think, in that project was both sort of very grassroots local and actually kind of became globally even, which is really beautiful to see. I would just mention a couple more examples. I think, you know, the Black Aesthetics Studios piece, which is the piece that looks at the intersection of urban planning and policing practices in Portland, that project starts with Cleo Davis, who's also the curator, co-curator, and Kane Talton Davis, sorry. And they work closely with an architect, Robert Clark. And so their project has a kind of Afrofuturist architectural dimension. It's three shipping containers that have been transformed into this new Black aesthetic of architecture. And then the content sort of within those shipping containers is very historical and based on artifacts, many of which were collected by Cleo and Kane Davis and also through the help of Kimberly Moreland, who has a background in historic preservation and local history, Black history. She's also the president of the Oregon Black Pioneers. So I think in that project as well, we really see the ways in which different practitioners within the community are then working together to build something very unique. And they, you know, all the projects were also very self-determined. And so the artists were building their kind of collaborative network from their own communities as well. And that is something that they did completely independently. And so there's also in the fabrication process, a collaborative dimension that it has a much farther reach deep into the community. So those are two examples. The last one I'll just mention is master artist Michael Bernard Stevenson Jr. He is a local educator who has taught and worked with Black youth, especially in a variety of local schools. And in his project, which looks at the history of policing in relation to youth in our community, he actually engaged a lot of students to help build his installation. There's also work in that installation that comes from his podcast, the Canphone podcast, which started at Columbia River Correctional Institution, working with incarcerated and as well as formerly incarcerated artists and individuals. And so that collaborative network also sort of reaches quite far beyond just the two of them who sort of started the project.
Yeah, Sam and I were able to visit on Sunday, and I'll just tell you that those listening, an hour is not enough. So plan accordingly. There's a lot to really dig into and digest there.
So for anyone just joining us, we are talking with curator Nina Amstutz and journalist Max Smith about the Policing Justice Project, which includes an installation at the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art.
There's also a film series and workshops and a bunch of other programming associated with the exhibition. Is there anything in particular that you would like to mention around that?
Our film series kicks off with the Portland premiere of the film Reimagining Safety by the director Matthew Solomon, as well as a short by Corey Alaya called Is Portland Dying? And so that's a multi-episode series that he's created, and he'll be airing episode one, which specifically has to do with policing in Portland. And so the directors will both be at the Clinton Street Theater, which is where our film series takes place. The films start at 7 p.m. And there'll be a Q&A moderated by Alex Vitale, again, our keynote speaker for the symposium as well, who is also in the film Reimagining Safety. And so that's a great kickoff. And then we have two local films coming up on March 21st, Arresting Power, Resisting Police Violence in Portland, Oregon from 2015. And then on April 4th, Aileen Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassa. And then the last film is on April 18th, Do Not Resist from 2016. That is a great film that, again, has much more of a national focus, particularly on police training and the militarization of the police. And so all those are definitely worth coming to see at the Clinton Street Theater. We also have two additional events coming up at PICA, actually in the exhibition space on March 24th from 4 to 8 p.m. We have an artist-led workshop called Artists, Power, and Practices, and that's hosted by Don't Shoot Portland and Mika Martinez, who is a local photographer who was very active also in 2020 photographing the protest movement. And they are going to lead a workshop with five other artists on ethical visual storytelling, which is great for any people interested in photography and filmmaking and working with vulnerable communities. That's a great place to learn from some local experts and practitioners. And then our last event that I want to just mention is a podcast launch and listening session, which will also be at PICA on April 27th from 1 to 3 p.m., and that's called Fight the Power, Do Not Harm, The Story of the Black Cross Healthcare Collective. And that's a new podcast, just a one episode, 1 hour podcast that's produced by Jody Darby, Hona Veerkamp, and Aaron Yankee. And it looks at the Black Cross Healthcare Collective, which is a group that is sort of a very grassroots healthcare organization that created an antidote or a means of neutralizing pepper spray. So they were very active in treating protesters in ways that of course, our medical system is less able to do and on the ground, right? So please also come out for all of those events.
There's a breadth of things to go see. There's no shortage or, you know, bad time to go. It'll be open for a couple of months. And we've got the films, we've got the symposium, we've got a lot of events that are coming up at different times. As always, this is Portland. Show up, you know, show up, get involved, but getting, you know, engaged, talk to the people. All of us are in and out on a regular basis. So even if you just come through, you'll probably see an artist at some point. Just come and ask questions, hang out and see how to really be a part of it. You know, we have to, I think a big part of this is building a stronger community. And, you know, this activities like this just help us to see who our people are. So once you find each other, you know, show up.
Yeah, I would just piggyback on that and say that, you know, the exhibition is, and we say this right in the opening wall text, it's about Portland and it's for Portland. And we really hope that the community takes ownership of that exhibition It's there to support all the community members and groups who have already been working toward police accountability for decades. And it's also there for folks who don't know much about this history to come and learn. You know, I'm an historian, and I always think the best place to begin in order to understand the present is to look back and see how we got here. And so we hope that the exhibition will provide that context, as well as serve as sort of a starting point for folks who want to get more involved to think about different ways of doing that. And, you know, I would just mention also, you know, one really beautiful sentiment that came up in our opening. We had an artist-led tour on February 23rd, and Ty Carpenter, who's one of the founders of Don't Shoot Portland, she said in her own reflections about her own project, that which is called the Center of Injustice, that, you know, we all have a role to play in creating social change and building the community that we want to live in. And that can mean really different things for different people. For some people, it'll be, you know, being on the ground. For others, it'll be handing out water bottles, and all those things are important. And so, you know, there's no bad way to get involved. So come on out and enjoy the exhibition and meet people from your community. And that's a great place to start.
Thanks so much. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you would think it's important to mention?
Maybe, I guess one thing I might add is that, you know, the exhibition, it's a really moving and intense experience. I think there are a lot of really heartbreaking stories that are told in the space. And, you know, we want our visitors to come out and sit in that discomfort. But also I want to say that, you know, the exhibition, I think, is also really hopeful, and it does imagine a better future. And so there are those two dimensions. And so come and notice all that hopefulness and possibility. That's really what we want folks to take away from the exhibition.
So we've been talking with Nina Amstutz and Max Smith about the Policing Justice Project that is open currently at the Portland Institute of Contemporary Art. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Jasmine.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. After the worldwide protests in 2020 that followed the murder of George Floyd, there were calls to defund or abolish the police. A new film called Reimagining Safety tracks this movement and attempts to start conversations around public safety. The film features 10 experts, activists, scholars, and community members who help viewers see a future in America without the institution of policing. KBOO reporter Matea Carlin spoke with Matthew Solomon, the director of the film Reimagining Safety, to learn more.
What was your inspiration for making the film Reimagining Safety?
Yeah, I mean, it honestly is kind of a product of my entire life up to this point. I was born and raised in Los Angeles. I was aware of the disparities with policing and how my Black friends in particular were treated differently, not just by police, but when we would go to the mall and things like that. So I was always kind of aware of racism and then social justice and racial justice. And then when I was going to University of Southern California music school in the early 90s, I was there at the same time as the Rodney King beating and the LA riots. And in addition to music, I was taking sociology classes because I was always fascinated with society and why we do the things we do and things like that. And so we were literally learning about systemic racism as the Rodney King beating and the LA riots and everything were playing out. I went into music. I was a professional musician. I went into filmmaking and started making scripted films. And then I started working in conflict resolution. And I was primarily doing that before the pandemic started. And then once that started and we couldn't go anywhere, I decided to go back to school. And I thought I was done with the entertainment business. I wanted to be able to use my privilege and access as a white male to be able to support social change. And so I found a master's in public administration program, of all things, but it was very social justice oriented. And so I'm in a public administration program and applying those topics to the issues with policing post George Floyd's murder. And I got really fascinated with, you know, what are the alternatives? Like, I get that it works as it's designed, but I get that it doesn't work. Policing and prisons don't work in terms of providing real safety, and it actually creates a lot of harm, especially for communities that have been marginalized. But I was like, well, what do we do instead? And that led me down like the abolitionist rabbit hole. And I was reading amazing stuff and learning amazing stuff. And when it came time to do my final thesis, one of my academic advisors literally was like, we know you know how to write a paper, but I know you're a filmmaker. Why don't you do something creative and do a documentary or something? And I laughed because I'm like, I'm a filmmaker. That's a lot of work. Like, you're not like I could write a paper in a weekend. But she said, do it anyway. And so I started reaching out to people to interview. I got everything to, I shot it on my iPhone and edited on my laptop. And within 3 months, I had the documentary that I submitted to class and got an A. And then, you know, we did a private screening and people were like, more people need to see this. This has to get out. Like, it's really good. It's really informative. Get it out. So I spent the next 6 months, you know, getting better graphics and getting a sound mix and getting more music and things like that. And then we released it about a year ago. And in the last year, we've had to date 45 screenings. Our screening in Portland last week was our 45th screening. We have a bunch more set up. We just got released on streaming on Amazon and Tubi and stuff like that. But yeah, it was really, it's really just a product of I care about people and I want people to be taken care of. And I recognize the need for equity and accountability and, you know, correcting the wrongs that, you know, that have been historically imposed. And so that's what led me here.
In the film, you interviewed 10 experts in the field to discuss policing and its negative impacts on communities. And I'm wondering, what kinds of questions and curiosity did you present to these experts in your interviews?
Because it was an academic project, I needed to have citable, reputable sources. I wanted to have a variety of perspectives so people couldn't say, oh, that's just a bunch of activists. You know, so with everybody, I got in, you know, I started with how they got into whatever they were doing, whether they were activists or prosecutors or a former police officer, mental health practitioners. There's a politician. Well, she's not a politician, but she ran for mayor of Los Angeles on an abolitionist platform. You know, so ask them, like you just asked me, like, how did this come about? I'm like, well, how did you get to where you're at? And how did that start? And then from there, you know, I had questions about abolition. I had questions about, you know, their experiences with police or as police. And then it was, you know, intended to be open-ended also. And so out of that, there's some amazing, really personal stories that came out of the interviews that I had no idea about. You know, I didn't know going in that was part of their story. And so I feel very fortunate that humanness came out. And it's something that audiences really connect with. And it really ties the thesis together about, you know, if we cared about one another, we would do things differently. And when we do things differently, we actually treat people with dignity and care and respect and those sorts of things.
Yeah, that I think the humanness of the film really comes across and makes it so like relatable to anyone. It's super valuable. What did you learn personally from making the film?
Yeah, that was really interesting, the personal part. Because, you know, first of all, I didn't know that much about abolition going in. And so, like most people, I assumed it's okay, we just get rid of police and prisons, but that's not really what it is. You know, what I got from the experience is abolition is really about love. It's about care. It's about treating people with dignity and respect and seeing the humanity in one another and, you know, seeing things from a more collective perspective versus like the rugged individualism that I was socialized with. And so it's really about community and taking care of people. You know, that was the, like one of the biggest things. The other thing is so many people in abolition are artists. You know, there's slam poets, there's visual artists, there's musicians, there's photographers, you know, authors. And that was fascinating to me because of my background as an artist in, you know, in music and film and things like that. And so that was cool also, because we have outlets for, you know, getting the message across and opening people up to new ideas, because we, you know, create art.
What misconceptions or misunderstandings did you encounter while making the film?
I think, you know, the biggest one, and, you know, we still get it, but then when people see the film, it actually really helps. And that's the misconception that when people talk about defunding the police or abolishing the police or, you know, anything other than, quote, reform, that we're just talking about like the Wild West and, you know, every person for themselves and it's just going to be like chaos and anarchy. And the reality is, and Maryam Kaba talks about this, she's a well-known abolitionist scholar, you know, the reality is that abolition is really about creating new systems. Defunding the police is really about investing in the people and investing in the things that provide real safety, which is, you know, housing and mental health support and food. And, you know, the absence of those things lead to desperation, which lead to, you know, the things that we call crime. But that's where, you know, the media and police themselves and politicians, you know, have been at it for hundreds of years, you know, convincing us that the only thing that will keep us safe is more police and more prisons. But if that were true, we'd be the safest nation in the world, because we have the most police and lock up the most people, and, you know, our crime rates are significantly higher. And, you know, a lot of that's by design too. But yeah, the misconceptions are that, you know, that we're just talking about getting rid of police and that it'll be, you know, chaos in the streets, which is not what it's about.
On a related note, what do you hope people take away from the film?
I hope that people, you know, people are at different levels of understanding with this. And, you know, so at the root, I hope that it opens up, you know, people who haven't thought about this or considered this. I hope that it opens up something where it's like, oh, there are other ways possible. And the system we have now really doesn't work. And it really can't be reformed, because historically, you know, we've tried everything, and at the root, it just doesn't work, you know, if we really care about each other and really want safety. So I hope that it opens up people to new ideas and perspectives. You know, on a larger scale, I hope that it creates momentum and influences policymakers and people in government positions to not only make changes to policy, but realize that they have support, they have public support in changing those policies. Because one of the things that's been frustrating, especially here in Los Angeles, because I'm from LA, is we elected several people to city council positions who ran on abolitionist platforms, and then all except one, you know, voted to increase the LAPD budget and increase pay and, you know, things like that. And so that's been really frustrating, to see people get into office who we thought, even our mayor, you know, at one point she was, you know, very much a police reformer. And that's not the case anymore. So I think that the more support there is for this kind of thing, and the more pressure we put on politicians to be like, no, this is what we really want, and you need to do this or we're going to vote you out. You know, that's like the, you know, higher level of what I'm hoping happens, is that we actually do create significant change and create safety and equity and accountability and things like that, to where, you know, somebody's not, a black person isn't three times more likely to be killed by police or incarcerated or pulled over, you know, even while being a third less likely to be armed. Like, these are statistics that are out there that just kind of, that really blow your mind if you sit and think about it.
If our listeners are interested in engaging more with your film, how can they do so?
Well, the easiest is to go to the website, which is reimaginingsafetymovie.com. And that has links everywhere. But, you know, the film's on Amazon now. You can go watch it and rate it. It's on Tubi and YouTube and Google Play. We're also still doing community impact screenings across the country. Hopefully outside of the country too, coming up. We have some stuff in the works, but we'll be in Washington State with the Black Panther Party and Stop the Sweeps. We have 4 dates in April set up already. And then some more stuff. We've been in like Newark, New Jersey quite a bit, and the East Coast and San Antonio, Texas. So if you go to the website, you can, you know, subscribe, get our calendar of events and, you know, be notified like when we'll be in your neighborhood, and you can come out and see a screening in person. And we always have a community discussion with local organizations and activists, so people can connect, you know, with what's happening in their communities and know, like, you know, because people are like, well, what do I do now? Well, you connect with the person sitting next to me and, you know, go to meetings and get in action and make change. So reimaginingsafetymovie.com is the website.
Awesome. Do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to share?
No, just thank you for having me and for the opportunity to talk about this. At the root of everything, like I said, I care about people, and I believe that most of us care about each other. Really, we've just kind of been you know, led down different paths, but I think, you know, when we really connect with the humanity in each other, there's a lot, like you said, possibility. There's a lot of possibility that's available. And so that's what I really want to impart to people.
That was KABU reporter Matea Carlin speaking with Matthew Solomon, a filmmaker from Los Angeles, California, and professor of conflict resolution at Antioch University. His film, Reimagining Safety, will be screened around the country in the upcoming months and is available to watch online. More information at reimaginingsafetymovie.com. For KABU News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Tune to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kabu.fm.